Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
One afternoon in April, I came up to the house from the shed to be met with illegal-sounding, raucous noise coming from the sitting room, the kind that used to be familiar from playdates and birthday parties. How many children were in there? 10? 15? 20? But there were just the usual three bodies in the room. Our three girls were on a screen each. A fourth screen was perched on the arm of the sofa. But instead of losing themselves in solitary screen time, the girls were each playing the same game, together. The game was called Adopt Me, and the point of it seems to be largely just to hang out in a slightly psychedelic world, trading each other for pet unicorns and the like. Each child had a character, an avatar, they call it, and all were appearing on each other's screens. And meanwhile, on the extra screen, they had a Zoom call set up with their pals, who were all also playing the same game and appearing on each other's screens. So, as well as seeing and talking to each other via Zoom, their avatars were all hanging out together in the game world, and they were all chatting by text in the game's chat room as well. The internet tells me Adopt Me has been played 14 billion times. I would have thought that my children this year must have accounted for a decent portion of that. But apparently there are often 600,000 players, mostly children, on at any one time. Now, that might sound like a dystopia. And indeed, one child in Australia managed to spend $8,000 on virtual pets for their avatar. Well, a fly ride mega neon shadow dragon here, a neon ride diamond unicorn there, it can all add up. But what were my kids doing in this perilous dystopia? They were playing hide and seek. Another innovation this year that might previously have sounded dystopian was the family Zoom quiz. Ours had an age span of 80 years, with faces appearing from Dublin, Cork, Wexford, London, Glasgow, Copenhagen, Berlin, and a village in Spain. We were lucky, of course, everybody was well. And the calls were exhilarating chaos, marked by the joy of a family brought together by being made suddenly aware of their separation. Many parents discovered this year that they'd been overscheduling their kids. Still, we were grateful for those activities that persevered. Drama classes shouldn't work on Zoom. Our girls sitting on our bed because the light is better in our bedroom, peering at their class in Zoom's gallery view. But they do their silly warm-up games and rehearse scenes and do improvs and don costumes for Halloween and Christmas shows, all sitting on the bed in front of the laptop. And the light in their eyes is not merely the reflection of the screen. Funerals shouldn't work on Zoom either. They shouldn't have to. Like theatre, funerals are not merely about observing. They're about being present. One morning in August, I sat in the garden at the funeral of the father of my oldest friend. Myself and our other oldest friend had spent the week to-ing and fro-ing about whether or not we would drive across the country to stand outside the church. His discretion won out over my valour. The surprise, as I watched from the garden, was how I felt like I was there. The later funeral was yet crueler, more sudden. We streamed it from the laptop to the telly and marvelled at the strength of our 12-year-old pal as he walked to the pulpit at the end to say a few words about his extraordinary dad. And then we went out onto the street and clapped our neighbour as the hearse passed and released balloons. And then we had nowhere to go, so I brought out a pot of tea and we stood and talked at a gentle distance. For the year wasn't merely about life lived on screens. There were walks along the Royal Canal till the path got too congested and reminding the kids to go in single file was too stressful. So we spread our wings. 2K got us to the Phoenix Park. 5K got us to the Poolbeg Peninsula or through town on bikes on the empty roads or into the sea at the slipway at Clontarf. We did musical statues and time trials on our street. We tried street bingo, but it turned out the bingo mic could be used for karaoke, and there was singing into the small hours. The words were had, a lesson was learned. bingo thereafter remained just bingo. There was a socially distanced parade at Halloween and individual boxes of goodies prepared by mothers in gloves and masks. There was nearly no secret Santa because the child entrusted with carrying the hat with the names in it was so enthusiastic running between the houses he tripped, and the names blew away into the night, perhaps to seed even more secret Santas elsewhere. If this was our war, TikTok was our Vera Lynn. Amidst the tragedy, there was also solidarity and empathy and innovation and imagination. Much about it was dystopian. That we had to do things in these ways was an affront to our dignity. But we did them and embraced them and brought dignity to them. Psychologists call that taking ownership. But you need to know where to draw the line. My girls can play virtual hide-and-seek in Adopt Me all they want, but real money for an ultra-rare mega neon fly ride golden unicorn? We don't need to own one of those. With faces appearing from Dublin, Cork, Wexford, London, Glasgow, Copenhagen, Berlin, and a village in Spain. We were lucky, of course, everybody was well. And the calls were exhilarating chaos, marked by the joy of a family brought together by being made suddenly aware of their separation. Many parents discovered this year that they'd been overscheduling their kids. Still, we were grateful for those activities that persevered. Drama classes shouldn't work on Zoom. Our girls sitting on our bed because the light is better in our bedroom, peering at their class in Zoom's gallery view. But they do their silly warm-up games and rehearse scenes and do improvs and don costumes for Halloween and Christmas shows, all sitting on the bed in front of the laptop. And the light in their eyes is not merely the reflection of the screen. Funerals shouldn't work on Zoom either. They shouldn't have to. Like theatre, funerals are not merely about observing. They're about being present. One morning in August, I sat in the garden at the funeral of the father of my oldest friend. Myself and our other oldest friend had spent the week to-ing and fro-ing about whether or not we would drive across the country to stand outside the church. His discretion won out over my valour. The surprise as I watched from the garden was how I felt like I was there. The later funeral was yet crueler, more sudden. We streamed it from the laptop to the telly and marvelled at the strength of our 12-year-old pal as he walked to the pulpit at the end to say a few words about his extraordinary dad. And then we went out onto the street and clapped our neighbour as the hearse passed and released balloons. And then we had nowhere to go, so I brought out a pot of tea and we stood and talked at a gentle distance. For the year wasn't merely about life lived on screens. There were walks along the Royal Canal till the path got too congested and reminding the kids to go in single file was too stressful. So we spread our wings. 2K got us to the Phoenix Park, 5K got us to the Poolbeg Peninsula, or through town on bikes on the empty roads, or into the sea at the slipway at Clontarf. We did musical statues and time trials on our street. We tried street bingo, but it turned out the bingo mic could be used for karaoke, and there was singing into the small hours. The words were had, a lesson was learned. Bingo, thereafter, remained just bingo. There was a socially distanced parade at Halloween and individual boxes of goodies prepared by mothers in gloves and masks. There was nearly no secret Santa because the child entrusted with carrying the hat with the names in it was so enthusiastic running between the houses he tripped, and the names blew away into the night, perhaps to seed even more secret Santas elsewhere. If this was our war, TikTok was our Vera Lynn. Amidst the tragedy, there was also solidarity and empathy and innovation and imagination. Much about it was dystopian. That we had to do things in these ways was an affront to our dignity. But we did them and embraced them and brought dignity to them. Psychologists call that taking ownership. But you need to know where to draw the line. My girls can play virtual hide-and-seek in Adopt Me all they want, but real money for an ultra-rare mega neon fly ride golden unicorn? We don't need to own one of those.
A hungry feeling. Tay more me stealing, and the mice were squealing in my prison cell. And the old triangle went jingle jangle.
On Thursday, December the 16th, in 1920, Charlie Schultz of the Auxiliary Division, RIC, writing to his mother in Scotland, lamented his company's transfer from Cork City to Dunmanway. For want of accommodation, we are billeted in the workhouse here. Filthy, dirty, he told her. To make matters worse, he was fighting a chill, caught the previous Saturday night in Cork City, where he was, he wrote, very actively involved until dawn on Sunday. The Auxiliary Division was a separate force within the RIC. Proposed by Winston Churchill, it was formed in the summer of 1920 to take the war to the IRA. A recruiting advertisement in the British press sought ex-officers with first-class record. Charlie Schultz was such an officer. He joined the Auxiliaries on November the 29th, the day after the Kilmichael ambush, and 3 days later was posted with K Company to Victoria Barracks. At first sight, the Auxies, as they became known, looked like stage villains to the people of Cork. Decked out in hanging revolvers, rifles, bayonets, and sporting bulging bandoliers across a dark uniform, their distinguishing feature was the Glengarry cap. But they were no play actors. In their first week, K Company had drunkenly looted and ransacked, shot two civilians and abused, assaulted and forcibly searched pedestrians. They carelessly discharged their weapons and threatened to shoot any male with his hands in his pockets. Martial law was introduced on December the 10th. An atmosphere of apprehension pervaded the city. Patrol activity out of Victoria Barracks became predictable. Two lorries of K Company set out at 7:30 each evening and travelled along the Old Yall Road through Dillon's Cross and down into the city. On the evening of December the 11th, Orderly Sergeant Charlie Schultz was organising the company to go out on a raid, unaware that less than 100 yards away, Sean O'Donoghue of the IRA's Cork No. 1 Brigade was waiting. O'Donoghue had just received information that an intelligence officer, Captain O'Connor Kelly, would be travelling with the patrol. O'Connor Kelly was responsible for the interrogation of IRA prisoners and, as such, was a prized IRA target. At short notice, O'Donoghue gathered 5 volunteers. 4 took up position behind O'Callaghan's wall, while the 5th, Michael Kenny, dressed in a khaki greatcoat, stood across the road. When the lorries appeared, Kenny stepped out and, succeeding in slowing down the first lorry, blew a whistle. The ambushers immediately jumped up, threw their grenades, fired their pistols and hastily withdrew into the darkness of Goulding's Glen. In fact, Captain O'Connor Kelly was on neither lorry. Amid much commotion, bloodied auxiliaries were marshalled into O'Sullivan's pub and then transported back to military hospital. 12 members of K Company were injured. Cadet Spencer Chapman would later die from his wounds. Shortly afterwards, the hearing of confessions at St. Joseph's Church was interrupted by raucous auxiliaries on the road outside shouting and firing their rifles. Churchgoers scurrying home witnessed truckloads arriving at Dillon's Cross. People were being dragged from their houses and the houses searched. Demanding information but getting none, the aggressors then began torching the buildings. 2 men wielding revolvers burst into George Williams' house. One wore a Glengarry cap. "They assisted me," he told the Strickland Inquiry, "in dragging my furniture onto the road. They doused it in petrol and set it alight.
They then went to the backyard and got the chickens my wife was fattening for Christmas. Wringing their necks, they threw them onto the fire. My wife and I spent the bitter night in the field. A lorry load of auxiliaries left Dillon's Cross, thundered down Summerhill and stopped the last tram heading north. Alan Ellis of the Cork Examiner described passengers being herded off, verbally abused and beaten with rifle butts. A priest had his cassock torn and was forced to kneel and say, "To hell with the Pope." Another group assembled at Patrick's Bridge and then proceeded down Patrick Street, shattering windows with crowbars and firing heedlessly. Mangan's Jewellers and Tompkins Wine and Spirit Store had their windows smashed and were being looted by policemen and civilians. Over at the Opera House, the curtain fell on the finale of The Gondoliers at 9:30. With only 30 minutes to beat the curfew, Jack Holland, who was playing Giuseppe, fled the theatre in his costume. He and a friend, racing onto the Grand Parade, got muddled into a group of drunken auxiliaries attired in ladies' corsets, dancing and singing before a blazing Grant's department store. Meanwhile, on Sullivan's Quay, Alfred Hudson, superintendent of the Cork Fire Brigade, had neither the manpower nor the equipment to deal with the flurry of incoming calls. As the firefighters worked, auxiliaries bayoneted their hoses and fired shots over their heads. Despite the men's best efforts, the fires at the Munster Arcade, Cashes and Roach's stores quickly spread. By midnight, the heart of the city was ablaze. For those watching from the suburbs, the skyline was a shifting orange radiance. Crossing the river in the early hours of Sunday morning, Alan Ellis came upon a unit of the fire brigade attempting to control the growing inferno in the City Hall and the adjoining Carnegie Library. Auxiliaries had turned off the fire hydrant and were refusing firemen access to water. After a deafening explosion, the City Hall and the handsome red-bricked library that had been so much a part of Frank O'Connor's boyhood disappeared behind a wall of flame. At dawn, the City Hall's clock tower called time on the night's and the year's terror by crashing into the glowing ruins below. That Sunday, local TD Liam de Roiste wrote in his diary of the calm sky, frosty red, red as blood with the burning city, and the pale gold stars looking down on the scenes of desolation and frightfulness. In the House of Commons next day, Sir Hamer Greenwood, Chief Secretary for Ireland, denied police involvement and instead suggested that the citizens of Cork had set fire to their own city. "Oh, we did it all right," Charlie Schultz wrote in his letter home. Never mind how much the well-intentioned Hamer Greenwood might excuse us. We took sweet revenge.
I had many things in common with my Auntie Terry. We were both December girls, sharing our birthday month. This year would have been her 92nd, had she made it past September. During the COVID weeks, when we spoke on the phone, she took the long view. "At least you have heat in your home," she told me. "I was always cold during the war. Not enough coal. Not enough sugar either." Terry and my mother not only lived through World War II, but had grown up on stories of the Great War. Their father and his brother survived the war years, only for the uncle to succumb to Spanish flu in 1919, while working as a doctor in Dublin during that pandemic. Survival in difficult times was not new to Auntie Terry. She told me of the sack of sugar her father had managed to acquire during the emergency, and how it had been stored upstairs above their furniture shop. How she had been asked by her mother to go up and fetch a bowlful. How she had been alarmed and close to tears to find that dampness had attacked the sack and that now the sugar was a sticky syrup on the floor of the disused room. The 6 years of the war seemed endless when you're a young girl from the Midlands, packed off to boarding school in Cork, clutching your ration cards, to be handed over to the nuns, to be turned into food you didn't much care for. But there were good times too, she recalled. Hiring a hackney car and driver for herself and four other girls to go to a dance in the next town 9 miles away. Sharing the cost between them was simple enough. Arranging for all five girls to leave the dance hall at the same time, with one, two or five of them stoking up a romance, was trickier. But she managed. So nothing changes, I thought, remembering my own discoing days and my daughter's taxi sharing after nightclubbing in town. She told me of the shock of her brother's death from tuberculosis, he only 21, she 12, in the winter of 1940 during the TB epidemic, and how she had to return to boarding school after the holidays, laden with this grief that others knew nothing of. She told me little about the young man she was in love with, who was taken by this same disease before they could make a life together. The quieter she was, the more I knew it stung. Like all children who have a significant adult, apart from parents, in their childhood life, I watched my Auntie Terry closely. How she baked soda bread and fairy cakes, collected rainwater in a wooden barrel, organised ICA outings, brought souvenirs home from San Sebastian when going to Spain was exotic. Later, as an adult, I flew to London with her in 2001 to collect the ashes of her recently deceased brother. It being 4 days after 9/11, we wondered would there be long queues at airport security. When the English undertaker handed us a large plastic jar of dark grey ash, she looked at me and I at her. "Security?" we mumbled. At the airport, I let Auntie Terry do the talking. "It's just my brother," she explained matter-of-factly, pushing the chunky jar along the hand luggage conveyor belt. The security man took a step back, either in respect for the dead or in awe of this unfussy Irish woman. In her old age, she taught me a thing or two about how to keep on keeping on. The week of her 91st birthday last December, she was happy to be driven to Dublin to attend a gig of Irish-Persian music and to join us for a vegetarian meal afterwards. Nothing fazed our Auntie Terry. "You'll survive this pandemic," she reassured me earlier this year. "It won't last too long. The war lasted 6 years, though we thought it'd be over sooner." This, although meant as reassurance, didn't calm me. But our weekly chats helped keep me upbeat. There's nothing like a voice that says, "I've been there, it'll be okay." It's been that kind of a year, 2020, when important things come into focus and less important things are seen for what they are. Well, unimportant. We lost my godmother, Auntie Terry, in September. I miss her this December, the month in which birthdays are in the long shadow of Christmas. I usually remembered her birthday, but she always remembered mine.
It's been a discombobulating year. As a journalist, I found myself working at home for the first time in a decade, with no colleagues to turn to in person and say, "Isn't this all so strange?" Alone and watching the news cycle churn, my mind felt like a blackboard scribbled with unintelligible messages. Every day, I'd need to take a deep breath and wipe off the layers of chalk. To help me do this, I turned, and still turn, to music. Usually my ear must be tuned to the stream of news stories that are developing across Ireland and beyond. But on my own in my spare bedroom come office, I discovered that there were snatches of time where I could listen to a song. And so certain albums became a portal for me to escape for a few minutes from the weird world I now found myself living in. As March turned to April, I sought out a 2012 Rufus Wainwright album I hadn't listened to in a long time, called Out of the Game. "I'm out of the game. I've been out for a long time now," sings Rufus on the title track. Though it's about his romantic life, the lyrics spoke to what I felt back in the spring. I was out of the game of the life I knew, and nobody'd asked my permission. But in Rufus's mellifluous trips up and down the musical scale, I found gulps of joy. He's a child of two musical legends, Kate McGarrigle and Loudon Wainwright III, and brings with him his own stories of heartbreak and recovery. When he sings, I feel the weight of his experience telling me it's possible to make it through difficult times and, crucially, embrace the happy moments too. Out of the Game, with its pop hooks, jaunty piano and operatic sense of scale, brought me relief. I'd belt out the songs in my office, with no one to hear me but the seagulls outside my window. Each time I sang, I felt a burst of emotions escape from inside me, like balloons into the air. As we moved into the summer, Tori Amos's 1992 debut album Little Earthquakes provided a different form of musical escapism. Just when it was becoming clear the coronavirus situation was less temporary than we had believed, I found myself obsessed with this record, which is all about the power in owning difficult emotions. Tori Amos is someone who tosses the listener her beating heart with every song. Her work is enchantingly vulnerable and visceral. I'd sing along to the album's opening track, Crucify, with its lyrics about being in chains, and feel the punch of the metaphor. When she sang about looking for a saviour, I felt I knew what she meant, even if there wasn't one coming along anytime soon. As with Rufus Wainwright, there's a drama to Tori Amos's music. Drama was in the headlines all around me, but I didn't want to be smothered by it. With Tori Amos, I got to rise above it all and sing with her as she railed against forces outside of her control. From Tori, I gravitated towards Joni Mitchell, who's long been the patron saint of a person wanting to exercise their emotions. As I noticed leaves starting to speckle with the touch of autumn, I leaned on her to get me around the tight corners of uncertainty that every week seemed to bring. I focused on her 1976 record, Hajira, which was mostly written during a 3,000-mile trip she took from Maine to Los Angeles. Hajira is filled with imagery of highways, motel rooms, and flying high. This album helped me escape in my mind, to float away on Joni's sweet yet steely voice to a time in the 1970s when I didn't even exist, with the road stretching out before me and an expanse of desert to either side. Musically, Joni Mitchell's album Hajira is full of space, and yet there are strange nooks and crannies in there too. It's imbued with the element of surprise that jazz brings with it. Each twist of the bass line is a lesson in acceptance. Searching for themes among the albums that have brought me solace this year, three stand out: escape, change, uncertainty. In turning to people who are part of the musical pantheon, I found comfort in knowing I'm one of millions they've connected with. Rufus, Tori, and Joni have reminded me how music can touch me deeply and anchor me in place. Can bring me, as Joni would sing, to refuge, even if just for 6 minutes and 42 seconds. I'm not on the road Joni was as she wrote Hajira, on that dusty highway going from east to west. When I look ahead, the tarmac is obscured by fog. But I have voices with me who promise support. And when they come in the form of a perfect pop song, all the better.
Across the burning desert, white vapor trails across the bleak terrain. It was the hexagram of the heavens. It was the string.
When you are the descendant of a hero, you live in their shadow. I tried to run from the overwhelming charisma of this boy hero great uncle, Kevin Barry, whose story was sung by Paul Robeson, Leonard Cohen, and every traditional Irish band you can think of. Yet my grandmother, Kevin Barry's sister, would not allow the song to be sung in the house. It was maudlin, she said. But Kevin wasn't maudlin. An oval portrait hung of him in my father's study, a copy of a painting by somebody in the H Company of the IRA. The face and shoulders of Kevin Barry had a slightly airbrushed look, set against a monochrome and patriotic green background. Kevin had a quiff of hair like Tintin, and he was wearing a trench coat with the collar upturned. He beamed eagerly round my father's study like a friendly family ghost. Beside this portrait was another one of my grandfather, Jim O'Donovan, in a rectangular frame, painted by Leo Whelan. A true diehard, my grandfather's convictions had him locked up long after the War of Independence. His face, in the portrait and in real life, was sterner and more chiselled. And when I was brought to see him in his nursing home, he never looked at me. I looked at him in his wheelchair, at his hand with missing fingers, blown off when he was demonstrating a hand grenade he'd just invented. I found the stubs of his missing fingers fascinating. And for some reason, we called him Beep Beep, although I've no idea why. I heard more recently that he occasionally demanded bottles of whiskey from my father and other visitors. He needed an anaesthetic for the past and for the tragedy of his wife, Monty, my grandmother, who lay prostrate on her bed down the corridor in the same nursing home, paralysed by several strokes. A woman of acerbic wit and sharp intelligence was living her final years in this terrible limbo. My grandmother Monty was the first dead person I ever saw. I stole a glimpse of her in the open casket at her funeral in the nursing home chapel. I never forgot her still, waxy face and the smell of candles and incense hovering around her. My father quickly took me out to the cold corridor with my cousins, and we were told to wait there until the funeral service was over. I heard the drone of praying and the priest muttering gloomily from the altar. She, Kevin Barry's second youngest sister, was gone. My grandfather was gone too, by 1979. They were all slipping away, leaving my father angry and intolerant of our inability to grasp who these people were. He wanted me to be custodian of our family history, but I did not want to do it. He would sit in his green armchair and tell me stories of how Kevin Barry cycled over the Wicklow Hills to drink in the hotels in Glendalough and Ockram, and how my grandfather locked himself in a room at night in the family home in Shankill, speaking German to his secret friends in Nazi Germany, and how my great-aunt Kitby, Kevin Barry's older sister, sailed to America with Countess Markovitch on De Valera's orders to fundraise for the Republic. But my father always came back to Kevin. Kevin spinning around on his bike in his Belvedere cap, drinking, dancing, pulling Belgian girls, out on the streets in ambushes, down alleyways, carrying arms. And in the end, hanging on the gallows, just like in the song. I resisted, but the stories seeped into me. There was nothing I could do because they were part of me. Although I grew up with these gripping tales of espionage and family militarism, it was Kevin Barry who made the greatest impact on me. The rest of it was just too frightening and strange. Such as my grandfather Jim drinking tea with Hitler, which he didn't, of course. This was a product of my overfed imagination. Or speaking to Hitler on his radio from the family home, which he didn't do either. I took refuge in our family hero, the boy who beamed at me from the oval portrait in my father's study. I wrote essays about Kevin Barry for history class, described the ambush on the Monk's Bakery in detail. I could see his face as he was driven with the British soldiers to Bridewell Prison. Irate, but amused. He was hanged the day before my birthday, and although we lived decades apart, his death was a shadow that followed me everywhere.
The Winter Pony. The boy leans back in the two-wheeled sulky, reins slipped between finger and thumb. His pony trots, fetlocks high, the cobalt hooves are cracking along. I imagine dizzying sparks that spit through the fog drift as they speed past Christmas-lit homes and trees, birch and oak, a grey shimmer of stars, branches splayed to fingerlets. The crack and whir of hooves and wheels recede, then silence falls. What remains is the long yawn back to fallowness, this Monday morning's grey road, grey fields, grey house, remote from summer's deep rustle, its tussled length of hours. Only this, the small pony and boy now swallowed in time, a slow iced air breathing from the north, roots entwined in the dark earth.
On this morning's programme, we heard From Screen to Street by Colin Murphy, Sweet Revenge by Lourdes Mackey, Auntie Terry by Nollaig Roan, Refuge of the Records by Aoife Barry, then Kevin Barry in The Umbrella Stand by Seafra O'Donovan, and The Winter Pony, a poem by Mary O'Donnell. The music was The Owl Triangle, sung by Luke Kelly, an extract from The Burning of Cork, Paul Frost's new orchestral suite, performed by the RTE Concert Orchestra, conducted by David Young and featuring Mia Cooper on solo violin. When the Lights Go On Again, sung by Vera Lynn. Amelia by Joni Mitchell from her album Hegira. And Kevin Barry, sung by Paul Robeson. And Seafra O'Donovan's recent book about her great uncle Kevin Barry, Yours Till Hell Freezes, a memoir of Kevin Barry, is published by Curragh Books. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey, and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.